take a giant step back for zombie takeout.
What's up? Welcome to episode 330 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-Moving Cult Movie Podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we've got some listeners submitted. This is a voicemail from Bodo in reference to last week's movie, Martin.
Hey, Bodo here. About the movie, Martin, you figured if he's been doing this for so long, he'd come up with a better knockout solution than something that takes 10 minutes? I thought that was a little pushing it, but I still loved it. I would have gave it 5 rings too. Another thing, D20, that's absolutely brilliant. We'll solve all disputes with a D20. World disputes, local disputes, personal disputes. Just think what a better place this would be. Just roll a D20 and everything gets solved. Keep up the great work. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Bodo.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, we went on at length about the knockout gas, or the knockout syringe. Yeah, it kind of suggests that maybe he hasn't been doing it that long.
Yeah, he'd been playing around. I think he'd said it was a trial and error sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think he just preferred it over,
perhaps,
you know, other drugs or whatnot.
And it also, again, suggests that he wasn't exactly a vampire.
Yeah.
And with regard to the D20, I have, you know, 3 sets of dice on my desk. And we needed
what else can we use a D20 for other than, like, settling episode titles? And
right. And we needed, I needed either a coin flip or something to decide between the two titles, so I went for the 20. But it also sent us a couple of tweets. He said, too bad you didn't do Moonraker this week. That was last week he sent this. Shark Week would have been apropos. And also, Diary of the Dead is a very good movie. I own it, and I watch it all the time. I think you're going to like it. So, a recommendation for Diary of the Dead from Bodo. Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out soon. Like I said, it's the only one of the Dead movies that I haven't seen. All right, so on to this week's movie, which is from 1979, Moonraker. Of course, this is our Roger Moore tribute. And, of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary. Sponsored by the generic European accent. Can't be bothered to learn a particular country's specific accent? Then try a generic European accent. They'll know you're from somewhere over there.
And also brought to you by skydiving fight scenes. Did they really fucking do that?
That's apparently insane. They did, because you just sent me, before we started recording, a YouTube video from, I think it must have been like an outtake or a featurette on the DVD,
yeah,
where they went through how they actually did that scene.
Well, right, because, well, I'm watching it. And the whole thing with, you know, Bond, mm-hmm, you know, pointing downward and swooping in,
right.
I'm like, oh, bullshit, you know, like, what are they doing here? And then I realized, wait a minute, there's no green screen here. I mean, except when they're doing, like, close-ups.
Yeah, the close-ups on Roger Moore and Richard Kiel's faces were close-ups, but everything else, they didn't have CG, and that was too big for a green screen.
Right, so, yeah, they got the skydiving champions and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
They really went at it in the air. The craziest goddamn thing I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, before that, of course, the movie begins with somebody stealing a space shuttle, which unfortunately, I don't think they told them how the space shuttle actually works. I don't think you would have quite that much thrust from the engine, but hey.
Mm-mm. Yeah, aside from that, that's just not how shuttles work.
It's a glider.
Yeah, with a little bit of propulsion.
The other engines do the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It's meant to move in a vacuum. It doesn't need much propulsion.
Right, right. So anyway, though, somebody steals the space shuttle while it's being taxied back. We have, of course, Bond, our hero, getting pushed out of an airplane and fighting someone for a parachute. And then, of course, your usual James Bond opening sequence, which I think I did made a joke about. I forgot which movie, but it wasn't that long ago that we had a movie that kind of did a takeoff on the James Bond opening credits.
Okay.
I think it was Cherry 2000.
Possibly. And yeah. I know we've done one that kind of does a takeoff on the ending of this movie, too.
So Bond, of course, has this mystery of who stole the space shuttle. But it seems like they know it's the guy who made it in the first place.
Yeah.
Being the main suspect.
Right.
Which doesn't make any sense.
No.
But anyway, this is one of the worst Bond villains, I think, because he pretty much does everything to do himself in.
Mm-hmm.
If he was just like, oh yeah, whatever, you know, hope you guys find it, you know.
Why would he have to steal something he made? That's the real plot hole.
Well, they answer that question later on, but and it is so absurd that they actually had to ask the question, why steal something that you made? Because I had a defect in one of them. All right. But, yeah, so if he hadn't stolen this, no one would have been on his onto his plan.
Right.
And no one would have been there to investigate him. And he could have gotten away with it.
Yeah, Bond and Holly Goodhead
wouldn't
have been aboard the space station and to, you know, capture him.
Right, so he goes around the world, literally around the world.
One of my suggested titles was Fighting Around the World.
To track down different pieces of the plan, and even though he knows that Drax is in fact the person that did it, and he attempted to kill Bond several times, he still doesn't just come right out and kill Drax, because I guess that's not very sporting. And he then, of course, joins infiltrates his plan to go to the moon for his hidden bases. And yeah, I loved your title of That's No Moon, because I was thinking it too. they're being, of course, chased by the great Jaws, who is, of course, the greatest Bond villain of all time.
Yeah. Did he speak in any other movies?
No.
Okay.
And he was only in one other film, too, other than this, actually.
One before it, I think. The Spy Who Loved Me, I want to say.
I think so.
And yeah. I only know that from my research. Hilarity Ensues.
And, right, well, yeah. So, in the middle of this, of course, he actually gets to turn Jaws to his side in the end. And, Lasers,
a firefight in space, space shuttle go boom,
and hilarity ensues.
Yeah. And I'll just say right off the top, this is only the third Bond movie I've seen in full. I've seen clips of several others, but yeah, I was never really a Bond fan. And now I know what I was missing out on. And I know this isn't exactly the best one to really, you know, get to know Bond with, but it was still worth it.
It's such a mixed bag, this movie. Because, and I don't know if I saw like a director's cut or something, but I don't think I did. It really could have lost a good half hour on it.
Oh yeah, of course. It's just over 2 hours, and it really didn't need to be.
Like the first two acts, I thought were solid. I mean, with the skydiving and the craziness. And then the cable car scene happened.
I was set to recommend this until he went to Brazil. Because that was just gratuitous.
It did. It fell apart in Brazil. I agree entirely.
But then the firefight in space happened. And we'll get to that. One thing I couldn't help notice at the very beginning, and yes, I'm a child, but the producer's name is Alfred R. Broccoli.
It is a very, very odd name, but I think it's probably Italian and...
Yeah, probably.
Holy.
Also, and I apologize for forgetting to post this, but I was looking at the trailer, I looked at it and completely forgot to post it on social media. It's 4 minutes, mostly action scenes, only gives away enough of the plot to whet your appetite. It's kind of a perfect trailer. It really doesn't give away any of the real story.
Well, their story sucks.
Well, yeah, that's true.
That's the problem. Yeah. These fucking guys risk their lives to do this crazy fight scene in the intro for a... Someone stole the space shuttle. Why? It was the guy who made it in the first place. I mean, he might as well have worn armor and taunted them because he was supposed to be an American. It spoke with the French accent.
Well, when Bond got to California, which is where Drax Industries was, he was met by a helicopter pilot with a generic European accent.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about her too.
And then he meets Drax, who has a generic European accent. And when they're flying over Drax's complex, which was a great model, by the way.
Totally a model.
It says Moonraker on one of the hangars, and I thought he was the stupidest supervillain ever, because, like, it's there. And then I realized, wait, no, he made the thing. Of course it's going to say it on there.
Yeah.
But the real problem with this movie for me, it isn't the plot. It's the fact that I just don't buy a 50-year-old Roger Moore as a ladies' man.
Well, I was thinking about it today, and that is really what this fantasy is about.
Yeah.
And I mean, and really, if you didn't know any better, if you didn't know anything about, you know, the culture of the times or all that much, you would have sworn this was a movie made in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that, I mean, other than the fact that they have a space shuttle and lasers, you would swear this was still made in the 60s somehow, because just the cultural attitudes that they have. And the fact that this is 79, this is like a more liberated version of James Bond.
Yeah. And it was just really before the shoe dropped too.
Yeah. But culturally, that's the fantasy that the cool guy, the person all the women want and the men want to be, is a middle-aged, you know, British guy.
And I bought him in the fight scenes. I bought him in, you know, the general, you know, suave, you know, super spy thing. I was fine with that. Just the sex scenes, just the scenes where he's hitting on these women, I was waiting for him to be laughed at.
Yeah, that would have made a lot of sense, honestly. Just like, what are you doing?
But again, with the action scenes, they are fantastic in this movie.
Yeah, that's
all of the explosions, all of that whole thing. This movie excels at. Even when at the beginning, when the plane blows up, when they steal the shuttle, I love that the actual plane blew up. It didn't just survive that. That was realistic.
Oh yeah, and so many bodies actually in this. I mean,
Well, he had a license to kill.
There were, not even him. There were just four people that died in the first 45 minutes just because they associated with him.
Right, yeah, true.
Just because they had the misfortune of meeting him.
Right.
Like the two scientists for him, like, you know, just breaking into the one room.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did I leave that over there? What's that? Boom.
Yeah. Well, they didn't even know him. They just had the misfortune of being in the room that he was investigating.
Oh, the one that got fed to the dogs. You have, and then the gondolier.
Right. Yeah, they just they don't even know him. They just kind of come in contact with him briefly. They get in his way and oops.
Yeah, they just get into his orbit and, you shouldn't be near him.
Just rolling back again to that skydiving scene for one more point. I loved Jaws trying to swim toward the circus tent.
You know, I've watched that scene 3 times since last night, actually. And I just caught that on the last one of him trying to, like, swim. Come on. The absurdity of all the situations they put Jaws into and still have him survive.
Because Bond steals his parachute, and he looks down and he sees this big circus tent, figures, okay, that can break my fall, and he literally tries to, like, breaststroke toward it.
Jaws was what I like to call the donk in this. The donk is, I don't know if I've ever explained this before. I had a crew that I was a dungeon master for that had affectionately, you know, they bought a donkey and they thought it was just cool to have a pet donk. And the last thing you'd want to do to me is show that you have affection for something.
Oh, you're one of those DMs. Okay.
I figured out different ways. The donk was Kenny pretty much before there was a South Park. He died in a different elaborate way every week. They're like, you blew it up. Yes, I blew the donk up.
Every week. Yeah. So they rezzed him?
I think they just bought a new donkey.
Oh, okay. They just bought a new one. You'll learn eventually.
But yeah, I mean, think about all the things they did to him. He fell out of a plane without a parachute. Mm-hmm. He fell over the waterfall. He, of course, lost in space and crashing to Earth. Am I missing something? What else did they do to Josh?
Oh, the crash with the gondola, the falling into the circus tent.
I forgot about the crash with the gondola.
Yeah. And then, of course, being thrown off into space. I'm glad that they established that they survived.
Really?
Like, one of the last lines of the movie is, you know, they've been found. You know, this tall man and a short woman were found.
Because he just found love.
Mm-hmm.
So much absurdity. And that's, of course, what the Roger Moore Bond was all about. You know, Connery was just a flat-out gritty, you know, well, not gritty, but just, you know, about the fight scene and and this was about, you know, kind of getting the zingers out.
He was a 70s Bond.
Yeah, he's kind of like the Joker in Batman, how, like, in the 70s, it was about the joke.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of absurdity, the title sequence was intolerable.
They all are.
Okay, again, not much experience with Bond, but...
Every Bond title scene is like that, where they have the nude woman, like, you know, silhouetted around and all that throughout the title.
It just didn't end.
No, it didn't.
And producer Albert R. Broccoli complained that Maurice Binder's title sequence cost more than the entire budget of Dr. No.
What?
Apparently, that title sequence cost more than the entire first Bond movie.
The worst part of it was the very beginning, where it was like a close-up on someone's crotch, kind of. I don't understand what that was. It was like a picture of a person, like, without, like, cut off at the head, kind of. It didn't make any sense.
Mm-mm.
But yeah, every Bond sequence is like that. I can't think of... well, at least I can't speak with the newer ones, but all of the Connery, Moore,
right?
Yeah, and I think even up to Dalton and Brosnan.
I did try to watch Casino Royale before I backed out, before I tapped out, and I don't remember that because I did see quite a bit of it. I did see, like, you know, maybe a half hour of it. The Daniel Craig Casino Royale.
Okay, yeah, because I thought
there was a one with
like everybody.
Well, yeah, what was his name? Clouseau. Peter Sellers.
Yeah, it was more of a comedy. Where
I wanted to clarify, not that one, the more recent one with Daniel Craig. And I don't think it had the giant title sequence in it.
But yeah, and of course it was always a big deal to who was singing.
Mm-hmm.
This one, of course, they went with, I forgot her name.
Shirley Bassey.
Shirley Bassey, who did, like, Doctor, or Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she was kind of the, I don't know, she was like your typical Bond singer, you know, the first singer, you know.
And I think she was brought in after they couldn't get somebody else, but I don't have it in my notes, unfortunately. They wanted somebody else to do it, and they weren't available, and they brought Shirley Bassey, was kind of like their stock singer.
Well, right. Usually it's, I mean, who's ever on top of the charts. Like, you'd imagine at this point they would have gotten, like, Donna Summer or somebody.
Did they do a lot of that? Because I only remember, like, one big pop band doing a Bond theme, and that's Duran Duran for, was it Living Daylights? No, View to a Kill.
View to a Kill. Well, I mean, they've had, like, Chris Cornell. They had Paul McCartney.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, Live and Let Die. Forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, yeah, that's one I've seen a fair amount of, but I was very young. It was on TV.
I'm trying to remember who else. I know they had, like, Sheryl Crow and,
Hmm. All right, getting back to this movie, of course. Onto the love interest, the Bond girl. I don't know if I can say the name of the straight face in this movie.
which one?
Oh, the Bond girl for this one.
He had three or four.
Well, the one he actually... Oh, true, that's a good point. The one with the interesting name.
That's the title. Oh, Holly Goodhead.
Yeah, thank you, because I don't know if I can say that with a straight face.
Not Falada Vagina.
Well, that was a takeoff on Pussy Galore.
Yeah.
Was she 70s or 60s?
I can't remember.
You don't know offhand. I just that the Holly Goodhead, even Pussy Galore, just seems so 70s.
Well, they love the entendre, if you had noticed.
Oh, of course, of course.
The ending was all about that. You know, uh-huh. He's about to make a reentry.
Right, right. And Holly Goodhead sounded like she was faking an American accent, and I was fully prepared for that after the generic European accents. I looked it up, and I think the actress's name was Lois Childs. She's from Texas.
Oh, yeah.
But even though she sounded like she was faking an American accent.
She's probably trying not to have her Texas accent.
That's a good possibility, yeah. She was trying to do standard American English.
Right, right. Well, really also what happened to Carrie Fisher was just that she was just hanging out with so many British people. Mm-hmm. That she was starting to pick the accent up.
Yeah, she was slipping into a British accent. That's a little different.
Right.
You know, Lois Child sounded like a lot of other British actors have done. You weren't around for it, but when we reviewed Horns, I dinged Daniel Radcliffe for this. He did the most absurd American accent.
Oh.
Even Hugh Laurie, if you know he's British, the house voice is kind of absurd.
I knew he was British, and I watched, I think I saw every episode.
Yeah, you're a big fan.
There were moments where you can kind of like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not that it slips. I'm sure he rarely slipped, but just that really broad Midwestern accent that he did. That's what they tend to settle on.
I don't know how Midwestern his accent was. I mean, they were very conscious that they were filming in, you know, that they were supposed to be in Jersey. And, you know, Pennsylvania area. But yeah, he carried it pretty well throughout most of the show.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he rarely slipped. Yeah, it was the accent he was doing in general that I was commenting on. But Daniel Radcliffe is another one. If you ever have a chance to see some clips from Horns,
I should see Horns just because
it's pretty good.
It's the one movie that we've done that I haven't
seen. We recommended it. So he does this really broad Midwestern accent. And it was kind of comical. Back again to Moonraker. One thing I have to give it a lot of credit for, it didn't over-explain much. You know, it kind of let you figure things out on your own.
Right, and I was just thinking of how, you know, basic an audience that had to have been back then, because, I mean, there's so many things. This is, of course, 2 years before the shuttle launched.
Right.
So, there had to have been people that were like, what the hell is this thing? You know, that not knowing that it was something that, you know, we'd been working on
right
throughout the 70s to get us back into space.
But particularly, I like the scene where, you know, he's in the centrifuge and the stop switch was disabled. They didn't show somebody disabling it. Nobody said it was disabled, but you kind of knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Because they pointed at it a little bit and said, you know, here's the thing, you can use to stop it, which made perfect sense as she's explaining, you know, what the thing does. But you knew the minute it was sabotaged that, you know, that switch wasn't going to work. Yeah. Who looked like he stepped right out of Enter the Dragon.
Right. Like, why did he have to have this weird samurai guy? That's
just, yeah.
That's just so strange.
Just the bowl cut and the mustache and the kimono. He would have fit right in and Enter the Dragon. Also, he had this X-ray machine that was part of a cigarette case. And, of course, the gadgets are a huge thing with Bond, and they were cool.
Right.
But an X-ray machine in a cigarette case that he keeps in his front pocket. It's no wonder that Bond wasn't facing, like, a billion paternity suits. You know, now we understand why.
He's self-sterilized. That's very convenient of him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, gadgets back then, it's kind of why I don't understand why Bond movies are still around, because, I mean, what kind of gadgets
can
really impress us anymore?
Right. Yeah. Now you can literally do anything with a phone.
Right. So, but I can imagine, I mean, we're just getting into the digital age pretty much at this point.
Yeah, true.
And, yeah, a lot of that stuff was just mind-blowing. I mean, I remember seeing this as a kid. I think I remember being very bored by a lot of the middle part, actually. And, like, when the fuck are they going to get into space?
Mm.
Because this has also the same problem. That's
what they were sold as.
Right. Like, that. This was sold as, you know, oh, it's their answer to Star Wars and Star Trek. It has the same problem as Star Trek the Motion Picture, as it takes longer for them to get into space than it did for them to get on the Enterprise in Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. I did like the hunting scene when Bond just, you know, looked like he was aiming for the quail and shot the sniper. That was very nice.
I was like, I don't know how he figured out there was where the sniper was. But I love to see.
Although the guy with the horn in that scene played the first three notes of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, I was waiting for that hit. You know, that memorable part of the song. I don't even know if he intended to play those three notes, but it just kind of happened that way.
Yeah, it was very strange that, you know, that he, the way he played it and everything. Mm. I remember, like, sticking out to me, too.
And I love the idea of the glass-handled sword in the museum, because that would actually work.
Oh, yeah.
It would carry a lot of vibration. You might want to wrap it. But the blade would bend before that glass would break, as long as it was, like, you know, a good inch thick.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of how that would look.
I like it going up against the wooden stick.
Mm.
And the look on his face when he realizes, this isn't going to last long. Because it kept getting shorter and shorter.
Although, why would he go after him with a kendo stick if he's trying to kill him?
I don't know.
I just thought of, there was a wrestler back in the day who always bring a kendo stick into the ring. And that's what you use when you want to beat the shit out of somebody, not when you want to kill them. You want to kill them, you bring a real sword.
Yeah. Well,
a kendo stick is really just a baseball bat.
Where you could just see Scott Evil going, let's just, you know, put one in instead. Yeah. Fucking be done with it.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you really want to kill me, bring a gun. But, I mean, if you're a samurai, you bring a real fucking sword, not a kendo stick. But just before that, we have maybe the most absurd thing in the movie. Well, okay, not the most absurd. The first truly absurd thing in the movie. There's this chase scene through the canals of Venice. And when did they go from California to Venice, by the way?
It was his first place after he was reporting back, because he had the glass
okay.
he was looking for.
Okay, because I totally missed, because first he's going to California to see the complex, and next thing he's in Venice, I totally missed that.
Right.
But there's this chase scene through the canals, kind of generic, kind of, well, cliche, I should say. But it was still well done. But then he ends up... somehow on this float with wheels on a gondola driving through a plaza in Venice.
Right. The gondola, of course, is a custom-made gondola in true James Bond fashion.
Okay, the gondola had wheels. Okay.
The gondola had the float and the wheels that came out when he hit a button. So he left the canal and left them like what? It was very Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much, very much. And again, to that fight in the museum, hated seeing all that glass broken. But I get why they did it. And the death of the samurai was way more gruesome than I was expecting. Because he falls out a window headfirst into a piano, and you just kind of see him dead, hanging in the piano.
And he has the great zinger of play to get sound.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, that one didn't quite hit.
No. Loved all of the weapons in Holly's room. Her room is stacked with all of these kind of spy weapons. And that's when he figures out she's CIA.
I love that, you know, it introduced other weapons in a different way than just Q.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
introducing them to him, or
because she's CIA, so she doesn't have Q, and she didn't get them from Q, so she's got them scattered around her room, and she's not going to use them on him. He just kind of notices them as they're talking.
Well, in reality, how easy would it be to kill Bond if, you know, mm-hmm. just send a woman out like,
yeah.
like
that? I mean, that's what they attempted to do at the very beginning, but then she pulls a gun on him instead of just, you know, poisoning him.
And she really could have killed him, I mean, if he had grabbed somebody's parachute.
Yeah, I mean, if she didn't bother throwing him out of the plane, if she just, you know, injected him on the spot, or, you know, even just shot him. It's a plane, maybe you don't want to shoot somebody. But, you know, inject him.
Already.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are other ways. She could have very easily killed him, but it's a Bond movie, of course. And speaking of killing, is Jaws' way of killing people just biting them to death?
It's being big, and it's, I don't know, he bit people to death.
Well, when he's going after the woman in Rio, he goes for her neck.
That's right. That was very strange. Suddenly he became a vampire.
Oh, but just before that, another thing I got to call out. It's a little jumping the shark, but I loved it. The code to Drax's room was the theme from Close Encounters.
Right. So many sci-fi nods that they were trying to...
because they were jumping the shark.
Fans. Yeah, usually it's like the third or fourth installment in a series they're going into space. This yeah. is like, they waited until the 11th.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's funny? This is taken from one of Fleming's novels still. Mm.
But I think there was a deal where the movie would have nothing to do plot-wise with the story, with the movie. With
right.
Yeah, but they would have nothing to do with each other, the novel and the movie.
Right, the novel was... well, they had Drax still,
okay.
who was a British. It turns out he was, you know, at first you think he's a good guy, but it turns out he was a Nazi sympathizer.
Ah, okay. Hence the whole eugenics thing. Okay.
And right, the Moonraker project in the novel was a missile system that he was billing as a defense of England, mm-hmm. but in reality, he wanted to turn it on England and destroy it.
That's a way better story.
Right.
I may have to listen to the book.
And it's also one of the only Fleming novels to actually take place solely in England, which angered some of the readers because they like the exotic locales, which this movie took care of in a ridiculous fashion.
Well, first, before we get to that, is okay. it just me or does the name Drax just scream supervillain?
Yeah.
But... okay, here is where the movie really jumps the shark and just lost me completely up until the ending. He goes to Rio and it is just egregious eye candy. They just wanted the show carnival and, you know, the giant Jesus statue and all of that. And, you know,
they
typical...
showed the giant Jesus statue. I don't think I remember seeing okay,
it. Maybe I'm just assuming they did because everything that shoots in Rio shows that.
Well, right. I was looking for it and I didn't see it.
But I know they showed Carnival. They made a whole big deal of Carnival.
Right.
Carnival, sorry.
A lot of 70s movies did things like that where they just went to a location just to be
mm-hmm.
at the scene like that.
And there's one scene with this random woman who's helping Bond. And they break into this office and Jaws shows up and that's that. And then he's back in Venice.
Like, why he left her out in the street anyway, I don't know.
Because it was an excuse for Jaws to show up.
Right. And why Jaws would attack her is another thing, too. Like, none of that made any sense.
No.
A lot of the stuff that happened in Brazil made no sense.
Yes, and that's also where, as you mentioned, Jaws goes vampire.
Well, right. Where that whole... the skydiving scene was fucking brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
The cable car scene was a disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
oh, that was in Rio too. I forgot. Yeah,
right. And you could tell they had some people that attempted some stunts on the upside of the cable car,
mm-hmm.
but I guess they couldn't use the footage as much. Yeah, I don't know why. Like maybe the doubles just weren't as convincing as they were in the skydiving scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have to really look at the skydiving scene to see that those dudes aren't right. you know.
Yeah.
Doubles from a distance, and you really have to look to see where their parachutes are.
Right, yeah,
because they hid all of that really well. Mm-hmm. I thought.
I didn't look closely, and I didn't notice anything. And I usually do pick that stuff up at the cable car scene. Yeah.
The cable car, they hardly showed any of the actual fight scene. It was mm-hmm. all close-ups of them, which does not make for a good fight scene.
And yet another ridiculous way to possibly kill Jaws.
And then the...
Oh, and the most ridiculous part, he walks away, of course. This gondola is out of control. He cuts a cable, the control cable, basically. And it crashes into a building. And he just stumbles out. And it levels the fucking building. It takes, you know, this stonework down.
Oh, yeah, the cable car, yeah.
And Jaws just stumbles out, brushes himself off, and he meets his girlfriend for the rest of the movie.
Which, I mean, yeah, I gotta give it something for that. I mean, I always thought that was hilarious to introduce a guy like Jaws, who's just a fucking scumbag, you know, really. Just this crazy-looking killer, this psycho. And oh.
And it was because Jaws was really popular with kids, and they would always send fan mail saying, why can't he be a good guy? So they decided in his last appearance, they're going to make him a good guy.
Why did they bring him back, actually?
Well, who knows? Maybe Keel didn't want to do it anymore. Apparently, those the dentures, whatever the teeth that he had to wear, were extremely painful. He could only wear them for a few minutes without choking.
Oh, wow.
So maybe that's why he didn't want to do it anymore.
You'd think, like, in the 80s, they would have had a way for him to do that a little better.
Mm.
I don't know. Like, he could have at least done one more with Roger Moore. You know, or one with Sean Connery, because they did that Never Say Never.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I was not prepared for Gaucho Bond.
What the fuck was that? That was, I mean, with the Magnificent Seven knockoff music. I mean, it was just, I mean... Why was that even in there?
Was it? It was right after the cable car scene, right?
Yes.
His next appearance, he comes riding up on a horse in this poncho with a hat, the whole gaucho look, and it's in Brazil. And he goes to this like converted monastery, and there's this amazing weapons demo scene.
Right. Then you have the usual Bond trope comes back and takes control, which is very welcomed actually A lot of nonsense. That must have been sponsored by 7-Up, by the way, because did you catch all the 7-Up signs?
I did not, but probably was.
The cable car crashed into the billboard, and then there was the ambulance.
Okay.
That had the billboard of the 7-Up, too, right after that. Which, by the way, just to get Holly Goodhead out of the movie for a little bit, they just have her ride off on an ambulance for a while. Mm-hmm. What the fuck was that?
Lazy writing.
Oh, yes. Right.
But then we get to the redemption. He finds this cave base that Drax was using. That was so 70s sci-fi. These women walk out in these white, you know, bell-bottom sort of dresses. Not bell-bottoms, but they're shorter than that, but they're cut very 60s.
Yeah.
And they're white and gold. It reminded me a lot of Zardoz and, you know, that era.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And was it wrong that I was rooting for the snake?
Why, did you have a crush on him?
Of course, Bond, you know, steps on a trapdoor and gets tossed into this little water feature with a giant python and has to wrestle the python. I'm glad it's not snakes that I'm phobic of for that scene. I actually like snakes, so, you know, I was rooting for the snake. I was kind of sad to see him kill it. Obviously, he had to.
If you were phobic of it, though, as my notes say, the snake was so real, so it's lifelike.
If you're phobic, that's real isn't real enough, I think.
You know,
it was clearly a big rubber snake, yeah.
Right, but when he held it up to his face, I mean, that was very fake.
And how is it that no one noticed rockets taking off, carrying shuttles from the Brazilian jungles? Apparently the space station was you know, cloaked, but the shuttles, the rockets taking off, lifting the shuttles out of the Brazilian desert weren't cloaked at all. You'd think that somebody would notice that.
Oh, right. Like, oh, Brazil's doing nuclear missile testing?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I have to wonder if the last act of Sharknado 3 was inspired by this. You know, sharks in space. It just has that feel where, you know, they, you know, in Sharknado, they go up in a space shuttle. In this, they go up in a space shuttle. They hijack a space shuttle. It had to have been borrowed from it.
Yeah.
And I got a big kick out of the voiceover saying, initiate docking sequence, and the next thing we see is a couple kissing. Because Drax is bringing all of these couples up to a space station to reproduce and create a master race, because he's a eugenicist. And, you know, he wants to repopulate the Earth and after he kills everybody with this toxin that he got from orchids.
His evil plan.
And of course, Jaws brought the random girl that he met after crashing the cable car. Because they're inseparable now.
I mean, they even played, you know, the love theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When they first met.
It was Summer Place is the movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that classic, you know, Summer Place love theme. Which I almost fell out of my chair laughing at. And at one point, they're going through the space station trying to shut it down or, you know, decloak it. And Holly says, you know, we're getting into a section where there's no gravity. They went through one short hallway with no gravity. And then the gravity was back on.
I was wondering how they did that, actually.
What, the short hallway with no gravity or the later scene?
Any of the zero grav scenes. I was wondering how they did. Like, if they just did... I've seen some old directors did, like, you know, they would do it in reverse, kind of.
Well, the bit at the end was harnesses. In fact, the elaborate set for Moonraker holds the world record for having the largest number of zero-gravity wires in one scene. The bit at the end where everything goes zero-G.
Oh, that's just wiring that they did
that's
in the
all, last? That's just wire work.
But there are some scenes where they were climbing around when it was just a couple of them, you know, him and Holly climbing around, where you could see, like, her hair... kind of floated a little.
I didn't notice that. Because what the scene I noticed that looked like zero G was when they were in that tube and they had their hands on the ceiling and they were kind of faking like they were in zero G. I didn't notice the hair moving beyond that. After that scene, it just looked like everything was normal gravity until it all goes zero G at the end.
Yeah, that stuff. I mean, that makes sense that they were using cables.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there were a couple scenes where they were climbing around. I think one when they were getting out of the cockpit. When they were docking before gravity restored.
Okay.
And another when they were going to uncloak.
Mm.
But it was like, oh. Yeah, I don't think they did the, was it Apollo 13 where they actually flew?
The Vomit Comet, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they used the Vomit Comet. At least I didn't hear anything about it. Didn't read anything about it.
Right. I assume that Apollo 13 was the first to actually... go into space to film it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not actually space. It's a regular,
high up enough in the atmosphere.
It's very high, but it's a plane that they go into the coast basically for short periods of time, and yeah. not the coast. They go straight down for periods of time, and it's basically an up and down flight path. And on the parts where you're going straight down, of course, everybody flies to the ceiling, and it's you're kind of weightless for a short period of time. As I understand it, and I might be wrong. Of course, they shut down the cloaking device on the on Drax's space. That's what I'm looking for. Space station, and the American and Russian militaries get in touch with each other. And of course, the Russian general is wearing red.
Well, yeah, the whole Cold War thing is kind of just taking a back seat to this. Of it's not ours. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not ours. Whose is it?
Uh-huh. And I was actually kind of surprised when Jaws turned good. You know, when he full-on, like, helped Bond.
Right. Yeah, I imagine if you hadn't seen this before, yeah, that would be a surprise. Because mm-hmm. usually things are very black and white with these movies.
Yeah, exactly. You don't expect a bad guy, especially someone as menacing and really as much of a pointless henchman as Jaws, to become a good guy.
But, yeah, Bond's logic was sound, because, I mean, you know, you're not going to be part of that master race.
Right, right. And then the Space station is decloaked, and you know the American military manages to send a whole shuttle up within what, an hour?
Yeah, something like that.
And a bunch of guys get out of that, and a bunch of guys come out of the space station, all in full EV suits and jetpacks.
And you're like wondering, what could they possibly do to them? And then,
freaking laser guns.
Freaking lasers. Like, I love that they kind of introduce it. So you think it's a prototype, all right, whatever. That's all you'll see of that. It was a cool little visual. Not realizing that the entire final battle is all going to be about freaking lasers.
Freaking laser beams in, not just in a space station, but fucking in space, floating in space with jetpacks. Saved the fucking movie for me. And it had all the Wilhelms.
Oh, yeah?
I didn't even bother counting. Like, there was one during the skydiving scene. There was, like, one Wilhelm when this one guy lost his parachute. And then we get to this scene, and it's wall-to-wall fucking Wilhelms. And it is the best cheesy 70s sci-fi I have ever seen.
Well, like, in the gondola scene, how many bullet ricochets?
Yeah.
It was, like, one after the other. That was also another classic 70s thing. You had to have the ricochet sound.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the space station just starts falling apart and goes zero-G and shit starts breaking off of it. And they all have to escape. It's Spaceball 1 at the end of Spaceballs.
You're right. I didn't think of that.
Obviously way before Spaceballs, of course.
Yeah. The line that really gave me a Daffy Duck moment was at the end where it's only 100 miles to Earth. He'll be okay.
This was Jaws and his girlfriend flying off in part of the space station.
Right.
Like I said, I was glad that they established that they survived, even if he didn't come back. And then they're trying to go. They're in one of the shuttles going after these pods that are, you know, going to rain down this toxin on Earth. And they're using the automatic gun on the shuttle. It was Drax's shuttle, so it had a gun or a laser gun. That fails, and Bond has to manually shoot the pod with the toxin down.
I mean,
could you get more Star Wars?
Garbage, really, the most dramatic way to end a movie.
But okay, turn off your targeting computer.
Yeah, I know.
It was totally the trench run, and Luke on the Falcon.
In all
and...
caps at the very end of my notes. Great shot, James. Exactly. That was one in a million.
That too, yeah, the on the Falcon. That's what I referenced on my notes is the Falcon. But it was so totally turn off your targeting computer.
Yeah. What a shame they couldn't have gotten Alec Guinness to do this.
Yeah. He would have been a great Bond. Was he young enough? Yeah, he was young enough when Connery left. He could have done it.
Yeah. Yeah, they could have got, well, I mean, I guess he was a little old by at this point. But
well, yeah, at this point, but, like, he could have replaced Connery. He would have been young enough. And again, of course, I have in my notes, good head, LMAO. Because I just couldn't stop laughing at that.
I was thinking they should have gotten Alec Guinness to have played Drax.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Okay, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He should have been way more movie villains. Did he ever really do a proper movie villain?
I don't know. All I remember him is playing Malvolio from Twelfth Night. Uh-huh. You haven't lived till you've seen Alec Guinness walking around in yellow stockings, strutting around in them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And the gag at the end of the movie where, you know, the Pentagon basically is calling the shuttle, or is MI6 or whatever.
I don't know how many different Bond movies they've ended like that.
They have ended other Bond movies. Okay, because I know I've seen that gag before. Other movies have borrowed that.
In fact, they may have ended every single Bond movie like that with Roger Moore.
Okay, and they're going to call to congratulate him and get a, you know, debrief him, basically.
The Queen's directly on, and we put the Queen and Washington on.
And you know, he's shagging Holly. And I know I've seen that in other movies, and again, I haven't seen many Bond movies, so I know other movies have borrowed that. And I'm tempted to say Austin Powers, because Austin Powers borrowed a ton of Bond references. But I think I've seen it in other things
Bond,
as well.
You know?
Yeah, basically. And the end credits, surprisingly short.
Yeah, well, when you show all the credits at the beginning.
Yeah, I guess.
You don't have to show them again at the end.
Because most movies, the end credits take like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It was only like 3 minutes. I misjudged how much more of the movie was there was left. One last bit of trivia. In March 2004, an internet hoax stated rumors about a lost 1956 version of Moonraker by Orson Welles. Supposedly, this recently discovered lost film was 40 minutes of raw footage with Dirk Bogarde as Bond, Welles as Drax, and Peter Lorre as Drax's henchman.
Orson Welles would have been an awesome Drax.
Oh my god, yeah.
In fact, it looked like that's who he was trying to be.
Yeah, pretty much. That or the Master.
Nah, I think he was going for Orson Welles.
Well, obviously they weren't referencing Doctor Who. And I think actually Anthony Newley's Master was maybe a little after this. I think he was 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Picture like the classic Tom Baker Master. That's Drax. Sequels and remakes?
Could they possibly make a sequel to this?
Speaking of Doctor Who, which has been running longer, Bond or Doctor Who?
I don't know. Where are they going? Up to 25th movie?
When was Doctor No? Doctor No, Mr. No. No.
That was Doctor No.
It was Doctor No. Okay, I thought I was confusing that. Doctor No was 62. It does predate Doctor Who by a couple of years.
Yeah, and like I said, the books go back to the 50s. So
Yeah.
All about the Cold War.
Now, if they remade this, who do you think could play Jaws? Because Drax is easy. Pick your favorite henchman. I'm thinking, I know he's done supervillains before, but Spacey for Drax.
Are we talking about a Daniel Craig Bond Moonraker?
Okay, or I mean, whoever gets to play Bond next. They've been talking about replacing Craig. I think he's maybe going to walk.
Yeah, I'm surprised they've kept Craig on for this long, honestly. I mean, they are giving him a lot of money for what I understand. I mean, isn't this the only property of United Artists?
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Interesting.
Like, isn't like this the only thing they put out? I mean, I think they tried to do Pink Panther, of course. Wow. But this is it. Like, the studio doesn't really exist anymore.
Oh, man. If they're going to replace Craig... And I know I mentioned this actor in reference to Doctor Who, but I actually think he'd make a better Bond than a Doctor. Chiwetel Ejiofor.
What?
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Oh.
The operative from Serenity. He was also in Children of Men. He can do the swab thing. He's proven he can do the action hero thing with Serenity. He's maybe a little old, but he doesn't look it.
Like I said, I'm amazed it's even, you know, still going.
Mm-hmm.
The series, you know. I mean, I get it, people... The plots are very simple.
Yeah.
I mean, we like the stunts still.
It's eye candy and it's
Fast and Furious.
Yeah, it's exotic locations and stunts and explosions and gadgets. That's what Bond movies are about.
Yeah.
And I'm really not just realizing how much of that I've missed out on. I think I need to catch up. But again, if they redid this, Drax is easy to cast. Again, my pick would be Spacey, just because he's an amazing villain.
Hopkins should be a Bond
villain. Hopkins would be great too. But what about Jaws? Who's Jaws?
I don't know. I just take a pro wrestler. I would take.
Okay.
Oh, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but he's he's a very charismatic pro wrestler.
It's been like 20 years since I've watched any wrestling, so.
Yeah.
You know, my
I'm
first
really
thought.
Trying to blank out his name.
Yeah, my first thought is Mick Foley, but he's probably a bit old for it.
No, he's like a kind of a long blonde hair. I can't remember his name though.
But yeah, that's a good point. You go for a wrestler, yeah, because he doesn't really need to do anything other than be menacing and, you know.
Yeah. And it's weird because I think the wrestler I'm thinking is normally a face, but I think it would still...
It would work.
Yeah. Just to be scary enough.
On to brains. Like you said, the first maybe two-thirds were great. All the stuff in Venice and California. And then Brazil ruined it for a while.
Yeah.
And then fucking lasers in space. And I had to recommend it after that. I'm going for.
Oh, man. I mean, it's... I'm going to give it a brain just for the parachute scene alone.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. Like, you could skip through about half an hour of Brazil. And then, of course, see the insane lasers. I'm going 3.5, though.
All right. And what have we learned?
I need to binge watch Kolchak the Night Stalker. They had a couple episodes of Jaws on there.
Oh, that's a show I should probably check out, too.
I mean, the actor, of course. I don't think he's actually playing Jaws.
Right, of course. Richard Gill, yeah.
It'd be kind of weird if he shows up with teeth of the show. Like, wait, what?
I learned how you kill 5 hours in Rio if you don't samba. All right, so until next time, we'll be revealing A Breed Apart. This is our Powers Booth tribute.
Yeah, I think Rector Hauer really sold
this. Yeah, well, we weren't really sure if we wanted to do a Powers Booth movie. You know, we couldn't really find anything in our wheelhouse. Then you found one he did with Rector Hauer, and if Rector Hauer's in it, it's in our wheelhouse.
Yeah. So, of course, it'll be in a couple weeks.
Oh, we're off next week?
Yeah.
Okay. Until then, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course, the episode itself, which you're already listening to. Links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and YouTube. Links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. And of course, if you enjoy the show, give us a little word of mouth. We appreciate all of the listeners we have, but more would be better. You also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review, up through the science fiction double feature, The Day the Earth Stood Still and Forbidden Planet. Although I think I said that in reverse order. Yeah, Forbidden Planet is first because I have them in order that they're mentioned in science fiction, the song. You also find the recommendations list. Like I said, if the fucking lasers didn't show up, this was not getting recommended, but I had to after that.
I pretty much had the same reaction of this when I saw it as like a 7-year-old, where it was like, why are we not in spaceship? Why are we going to Brazil? Go to fucking space. Okay.
I mean, the Venice stuff was cool and all, but fucking lasers in space.
Yeah.
Of course, you can email us on zombietakeout@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 401-436-8-ZT01 or for the alphanumerically challenged.
You can go bite yourself.
414-368-9861. Of course, always remember that you will always be calling from the middle of Milwaukee. And until next time, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.
Rest in peace, Mr. Moore.
I didn't think I'm ever going to fly with anyone else.
Did you mute yourself again?
I did.
Ah.
Well, thank you. Just bring that up every time you don't hear me.